Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. April 11, 2021. The Holocaust is not history but actual world problem. Every year we mark the Holocaust Remembrance Day to honor the memory of the victims, 6 million European Jews. However, as years go by distancing us more and more from this event, the memory of it begins to fade. Many young people have not heard the stories about Holocaust in their families and have never met with witnesses of these terrible events. Therefore, there is a fear that the memory of the Holocaust may disappear because after a certain number of years there will be no living witnesses of the Holocaust, and there will be no one to pass this story on to the next generations. This should not surprise us, because these are laws of nature. Things that are not in front of our eyes gradually cease to be important, and if we do not want to lose them, we must constantly renew them as if reviving those pictures. No matter how much we tried to maintain this memory, arranged study trips to concentration camps for school children, it does not help much. As living witnesses of the Holocaust disappear, a new generation that is not related to this time will no longer be able to observe this tradition the way it used to be. I was born in Belarus, in a place where Nazis carried out mass executions of Jews. In Vitebsk, the city of my childhood, there was also a ghetto, which was destroyed. Many of my relatives died in the Holocaust. Although I was born after the war and knew about it only from stories, this memory was still very alive in our family. I was raised by people who managed to escape the Holocaust, and they told me about those who died. This left a very deep impression on me because I have lived in this atmosphere since I was born. However, if modern young people have not heard about the Holocaust from their loved ones, have not spoken with eyewitnesses, then for them, it is as if it did not happen. We cannot blame them for that. It makes no sense to sit and cry, but it is very important to determine our attitude to the Holocaust, to analyze again its causes and consequences. Otherwise, we will not get rid of the Holocaust or we will even come to a new one. We must draw conclusions from the Holocaust and change ourselves so that it will never happen again. We must understand why it happened and who is to blame. This is serious scrutiny that we must perform within each of us, and ultimately with all of humanity because everyone participated in this. How did it happen that the nations of the world accepted and readily implemented Hitler's plan without any questions or doubts? First of all, we need to understand who the people of Israel are, why they are called that, and what their purpose is. Why did they survive after so many generations of scattering and why did all of mankind pay so much attention to it? Until we answer all these questions, we will not be able to understand what we are talking about at all. Why do all nations make some kind of claims against Jews? It is clear that there are quarrels between neighbors, but why does everyone have complaints against Jews? We need to investigate this phenomenon and understand the exact causes. After all, this is not only history but an actual, global problem that does not disappear but only occasionally calms down a little and then intensifies again. This intensification does not really depend on the Jews or the nations of the world but simply happens because a suitable period in history comes. We see that anti-Semitism is deeply rooted in nature. There is such a concept as Israel, the people of Israel, the land of Israel. It is a spiritual concept that lives in the world and exists from the beginning of creation to the very end. This problem will continue to exist until Israel brings the entire creation to the correct form. This is what the Torah and, even more clearly, the wisdom of Kabbalah says. Without the Kabbalistic explanation of the causes of anti-Semitism, we cannot find a solution regarding the Holocaust and, in general, to all of history, to the entire creation. After all, this is not an earthly problem of the people of Israel, but the confrontation of the forces of nature, like a physical, chemical, or mathematical law. There are special relations between the parts of creation as absolute, unchangeable laws that are set and cannot be violated. The central law among all these principles concerns the existence of the people of Israel, the land of Israel, the beginning and the end of creation, and the entire process between them regarding any particle of the universe. All this is connected together in one system in which we are included as a central force. Natural anti-Semitism is the consequence of every person's inclination for bestowal, love for his neighbor, for the Creator, for the upper force. Although this force is hated and rejected by everyone, it exists, and to the same extent there is also a force of rejection and hatred toward those who represent this force in our world, that is, for the quality called Yehudi from the word Yehud-unity. From CAB TV's A Conversation with Journalists, April 6, 2021. My new article on LinkedIn: Are Jews also to blame for the U.S. border crisis? The situation at the border should be called by its name, a crisis. The U.S. border crisis is close to a disaster for the country on multiple levels. First and foremost, the human. Nearly 19,000 children and teenagers traveling without a parent were stopped by U.S. Customs and Border Protection in March, the most ever in a single month. Those children joined already crammed cage-style detention centers where they stay in deplorable conditions, are at risk for contracting coronavirus, and allegedly are exposed to physical violence and sexual assault. What does this forebode for the future? And what does it have to do with the Jews? So we may ask, how could the border crisis possibly be connected to us? The link stems from one reason: we live in a global world, a network of intricate interconnection, in which Jews are held accountable for everyone's well-being, or conversely, for everyone's predicaments. Illegal immigration to the U.S. is not a new phenomenon, but with President Biden coming to power and abolishing Trump's zero-tolerance policy, the borders have been literally overrun. Immigrants from Mexico and Central America feel the doors are wide open. As a result, in March alone over 170,000 migrants were apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border, a 71% spike over February's official statistics, and the pace continues to accelerate. I am not a member of the UN or any international human rights organizations that deems it their responsibility to fix the immigration problem. Rather, I am a public figure who agreed with Trump's rigid stance regarding building a wall to make clear that without a visa, there can be no entry. Only then would it be possible to consider the right steps for the absorption of immigrants so that the mental and physical anguish at the borders could be avoided, at the very least. For now, all the steps of President Biden and those around him are aimed at undoing the political trajectories that Trump established during his time in office. This obliges Biden and those who follow him to begin again from the ground up. The question is, how high will the human cost be to start over from scratch? How much suffering and sorrow, hunger and pain will be endured? Nothing good will come out of this new policy of open borders, only social collapse. America may well sink. Entrepreneurs and businessmen, one by one, will begin to abandon the land of opportunity, that is, diving into misfortune, instability, and insecurity, and will look for new possibilities in other countries like Canada. Even Cuba will look more promising. Just as the American forefathers emigrated from Western Europe to America, so too will businessmen and entrepreneurs begin to migrate outside the borders of America to set up factories and offices, establish banks and businesses. These new changes will shake the United States to the core. The people who rule the country will be unable to control the chaos and will lead society to total destruction in the so-called name of democracy. From the incompatibility of worldviews and general dissatisfaction with the direction the country is heading, social unrest may erupt. American society, in all its sectors and communities, is in a process of gradual evolution. Until the desired maturity is reached, there must be a stable government with leaders who have a vision of the nation's progress, who know how to wisely motivate millions of people to move the country forward. This is how England, Germany and France were built over hundreds of years. It is impossible one fine morning to allow millions of immigrants from underdeveloped countries to enter and expect them to suddenly assimilate into society. It is impossible to instantly extend to them the reins of power in the name of liberalism without completely disrupting the process of smooth development. I do not underestimate the will of migrant workers or the situation of refugees suffering from poor conditions and without basic human rights in their homelands. On the contrary, my heart goes out to each and every one of them. But at the political level, there are laws and protocols that need to be followed. An integration program must be established as part of the US immigration policy, a process to allow each immigrant to learn the language, get to know the local culture in depth, and understand the laws and norms accepted in society. This can only happen under leadership that designs and implements a clear and orderly plan. A government that does not know how to stop the crisis before it explodes will inflict disaster on itself. And for now, the Biden government appears to be degenerating into total mayhem. Although the Biden administration is now preoccupied with its breached borders, when the storm subsides, its next problem to tackle will be the state of Israel. In the current US government's sweet dream, which is a nightmare for most Israelis, a Palestinian state will be established on Israeli soil and that will be our end. While there is silence on this issue now, later the increasingly malicious message against Israel will resonate loud and clear. From the road to inflicting wounds on the Jewish state is short indeed. And why would such thoughts even arise in the heads of the American administration? Because the Jews who supported and still support Biden are willing to risk Israel's future. This may sound like rough stitching between two entirely different conflicts, but no. The border crisis in the US, along with many others, is like a snowball beginning to roll from the top of a very steep slope, accumulating problems and troubles along the way. Just as Jews have historically been accused of being responsible for pestilences and conflicts, the same scenario will unfold here. We are one step closer to also being blamed for the border crisis, as anti-Semites proclaim, the Jews are guilty of all the evil in the world. So we may ask, how could the border crisis possibly be connected to us? The link stems from one reason: we live in a global world, a network of intricate interconnection, in which Jews are held accountable for everyone's well-being, or conversely, for everyone's predicaments. There is a general perception that Jews are not performing the role assigned to them by the ancient wisdom they hold, the secret of eternity, which they fail to reveal to every person on this planet so we can all achieve the ultimate happiness. This ancient wisdom is called the wisdom of connection and it teaches how the world is built, what its purpose is, and how we can create one human family that functions as an egalitarian society that cares for the weak as well as the strong. As it is written, no calamity comes to the world but for Israel. Yevamot 63. The first chief rabbi of the land of Israel, Rav Kook, also wrote, humanity deserves to be united into a single family. At that time all the quarrels and the ill will that stem from divisions of nations and their boundaries shall cease. However, the world requires mitigation, whereby humanity will be perfected through each nation's unique characteristics. This deficiency is what the Assembly of Israel will complement. And in the words of foremost Kabbalist Yehuda Ashlag, Baal HaSulam, the people of Israel, which has been chosen as an operator of the general purpose and correction, contains the preparation required for growing and developing until it moves the nations of the worlds, too, to achieve the common goal. In a nutshell, we need to implement what is deeply ingrained in our core values and heritage, our ability to connect as one man with one heart. When we put this law of nature into practice, we will truly become a light unto the nations, spreading an orderly system throughout the world and radiating warmth and love. This is the one and only mechanism for fending off threats and recovering the world's balance. The Creator will gladly help us. It is clear that we are not able to change our nature from egoistic to altruistic. It is like rising from the level of created being to the level of the Creator. Of course, it is not in our power because we are just created beings and rather low. Obviously, we have the chance to grow, but this is still ahead of us. The more we try to rise to the spiritual reality, the deeper we plunge into the corporeal world because the Creator created one against the other. It is due to both forces, Pharaoh and the Creator, and learning how to use them correctly so that we rise between the two, in the middle line, toward the Creator. Of course, we cannot unite in the ten by ourselves, but we can ask the Creator to help us connect. But it is impossible to ask until we have tried to do it ourselves. That is, we make efforts to connect and discover how different we are, that do not accept each other, how lazy we are and do not understand what connection is, or what it means to be one man with one heart. When we fall into despair from our attempts, we turn to the Creator. Now we have something to show Him. Look, we tried everything and nothing works. You must help us. But if we did not start trying on our own, the Creator would not be able to help us. He always makes corrections to our unsuccessful attempts. All our work is to try to do something, and after that we have the right to turn to the Creator and He will help us, with great joy. After our own attempts, we realized where the shattering occurred and how to correct it, and that we ourselves are not capable of it. When a person tries to achieve unity on his own, that is, the spiritual degree where he is united with others, he reveals his helplessness. He understands that he has no feelings, no understanding of how to do this, and he needs to receive the upper force, the upper desire for this. That is, he lacks the work in the mind and heart. The Creator does everything, but we must come to him with despair from the work that we tried to do and did not succeed. Until we try it ourselves, we do not know what to ask for. From the Daily Kabbalah Lesson, April 4, 2021, Pesach, Passover. My new article on LinkedIn: COVID not incentive for anti-Semitism. The Ministry of Diaspora Affairs 2020 Anti-Semitism Report argues that last year was good in the sense that in the previous year, no Jews were murdered for being Jews. At the same time, the report laments the rise of what it considers the most decisive power driving anti-Semitism in the previous year, the COVID-19 pandemic. We should know better. Jews have always been blamed for the world's woes. Were Jews not blamed for the Black Death in the Middle Ages? Were Jews not blamed for Germany's woes before World War II broke out? And when Jews aren't blamed for something as tragic as the Black Death, they're still blamed for every little pain. In fact, Jews are hated even when there is nothing at all to blame them for. Unless, of course, we put a stop to it. We, Jews, are the unexpected holders of the key to ending anti-Semitism. And once again, it is not a circumstantial solution. Nor is it a matter of policy, ideology, or stifling of anti-Semitic outbursts. We can and should apply sticking plaster solutions when possible, but we must not think that they will solve the problem. If we believe they will, reality will explode in our faces. These days, the trend is to blame Israel for the intensification of anti-Semitism, as though this or that policy of the Israeli government will change how the world feels about Jews. I was born in Eastern Europe right after the war. Almost my entire family perished in the Holocaust. There was no state of Israel to blame, and my family certainly didn't cause the downfall of Germany in World War I, but they were murdered nonetheless. Their only fault was that they were Jews. Once it is legitimate to assail Jews, no pretext is needed, and no brutality is off limits. According to the Internet Archive, since the Bar Kokhba revolt, which ended in 135 C, Jews have been expelled from their host countries, or altogether exterminated, more than 800 times. These pogroms predate the State of Israel, racism, and even Christianity. In fact, Anti-Semitism is as old as Judaism itself. Therefore, if we want to find the solution to Jew hatred, we have to look deeper than attributing it to some passing crisis that is here today and gone tomorrow. But perhaps the most intriguing fact about Jew hatred is the apparent dichotomy between the development of a country and the intensity and ferociousness of its anti-Semitism. Of all the countless atrocities that non-Jews have inflicted on Jews, none did so more potently and painfully than the most powerful nations of their time. Egypt under Pharaoh was the first, followed by Babylon, which ruined the first temple. Then came Greece with the temporary destruction of the second temple, followed by Rome, which destroyed the second temple beyond repair and let the Jews destroy each other in a gruesome civil war. In the 15th century, Spain, a mighty and enlightened empire, expelled all the Jews from its midst in the second most traumatic event since the ruin of the Second Temple, and finally, the Holocaust that Nazi Germany had wrought on European Jewry was the worst trauma since the ruin of the Second Temple. In all those episodes, the decimators were the most advanced, cultured, and civilized nations of their time. But at some point, something made them turn against the Jews and let the monster loose. Since this pattern has persisted throughout history, and only the pretexts changed to suit the circumstances, there is no reason to expect it to change going forward. The future of the Jews, it seems, is bleak, and another blow is nearing. Whether it will strike the State of Israel, American Jewry, or both is anyone's guess. But there is no question that the two most developed and advanced Jewish communities are the targets of the next great blow to the Jewish people. Unless, of course, we put a stop to it. We, Jews, are the unexpected holders of the key to ending anti-Semitism. And once again, it is not a circumstantial solution. Nor is it a matter of policy, ideology, or stifling of anti-Semitic outbursts. We can and should apply sticking plaster solutions when possible, but we must not think that they will solve the problem. If we believe they will, reality will explode in our faces. The real solution lies not with the world, but with the Jews themselves. This is why this hatred persists through any circumstance. We must look for the solution not in how the world treats us, but in how we treat ourselves. Our relationships with one another generate the hatred of the nations toward us. It may sound outlandish, but our sages have known this throughout the ages, yet the people were reluctant to heed their advice. Note that our sages do not attribute the ruin of the first temple to the Babylonian conquest, but to the bloodshed and corruption within Israel. Likewise, they do not attribute the ruin of the second temple to the Romans, but to baseless hatred of the Jews for one another. Time and time again, they tell us, that if we unite, no harm will come to us. Time and time again we pay them no attention, conveniently adopt the victim narrative, and blame our woes on others. When I look at the global political climate, I do not think it bodes well for the Jews. I don't know how much time we have. But I do not believe it will be very long before the dark clouds on the horizon amass into a storm front that will unleash its wrath on the Jews. Worse yet, from what I can see, it will not be a single country that will give a free rein to hatred, but the entire world. There will be no escape. This is why I think it is so urgent that we apply the one cure we haven't tried since before the ruin of the temple, unity. The incentive for anti-Semitism, our sages tell us, is our hatred of each other, and the cure for it is our unity, as one man with one heart. For more on this topic, you may refer to the books like A Bundle of Reeds, Why Unity and Mutual Guarantee Are Today's Call of the Hour and The Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism, Historical Facts on Anti-Semitism as a Reflection of Jewish Social Discord. New Life 1086. Recognizing Good and Evil.
Hello, and thanks for being with us here on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Tal Mandelbaum. Hello. Today, we'd like to talk about how to be a good person. We'd like to better understand what does it mean to be a good person? How can we learn and teach others to be better people, our children, for example? Be with us. It's going to be really interesting. Tal, please. Yeah, it's really important for us to talk about it, especially now when we as parents, as society, want to raise our children to become better people. Surveys show that empathy is in decline. We hear about the distress that children are experiencing, boycotts at school and so on. And there are many problems in terms of how children treat each other. And we'd like to understand, what is a good person? What should we direct our children at? What is the example that we actually have to show our children? Now, we know that a good person is someone who's pleasant to others, behaves nicely, takes others into consideration, gives, contributes. And this is the example that we have of what a good person is. Now, where did our perception about what a good person is come from? From our ego. As simple as that. I want to be surrounded by nice people. Good people, pleasant people that behave nicely, pleasantly, treat me favorably. And that's it, and I'm well off. This is what a child wants, and we really see that this is also how nature arranges things for children. First of all, a child's mother, then the other relatives, that he's raised on their hands practically in a good and nice way, and we'd like to feel this way all throughout life. Now, the question is, why doesn't nature arrange it so for us? Right. So it's a good question. We're reaching a state where our childhood, our adolescence comes to an end, and we suddenly see that the world isn't such a great place to live, grow up in. I think that nowadays children discover it much earlier. Right. And so the question is, why did nature arrange things this way? Because I see that this is how it is for everyone. For animals, everywhere practically this is how it is. That we're in an environment where we're loved until we don't even have the chance to fully grow up, and we go into this really bad world, the very opposite of what we thought before. And then I suddenly discover that I'm afraid of different things, different events, different things that happen that come to me. Why? Why is the world bad? And this is how it is for everyone. We also see that this existential war happens on all levels, and all the more regarding man himself. He suffers from everyone, and in such a way that were we not to build different systems that could strengthen him, protect him, I don't know who'd reach adulthood altogether. It's a problem. It's a problem, and nature is arranging it this way for us so that, first of all, we the grown-ups will be concerned with how to make this world a better place. Meaning that the entire emphasis is on education, on how do we raise a better society with better, more pleasant people. I think that this is something that everyone aspires for. So is this really the image that you see as a good person that we should aspire for? Because you said that it comes from our ego. We don't understand what a good world, a good person is. To be good, we don't understand what that is. We understand everything, feel everything, decide everything according to our ego. And our ego It can't be good, because by nature, as an egoist, I think about myself. I can take others into consideration to the extent to which I'll benefit from it myself, but if I don't, I can't. I can't think about it. It's very simple. By nature, I'm built this way that I, myself, am incapable of being good to others simply so, just so. If I am good to others, it's because it's beneficial for me in some way. And then I treat them correspondingly to that extent. I treat them nicely, meaning that I want to benefit from them, something in return. And only to the extent to which it's beneficial to me, and only. And therefore, our world can't be good because it's always based on everyone wanting to succeed, to benefit, to do good to others in order to receive from others. And only to that extent, it's called good. Meaning even the good that I do to others, it's not that I do it to others, but I do good to myself, actually. And therefore, the world can't be good. It's only in the case of parents and their children. That then, regarding their children, they want for their children to feel good, to be well off, but it's an instinct, otherwise life wouldn't continue. But besides that, on the internet there are many clips of how people help other people, and they give and give, and eventually how it makes them feel good, and how they become happier as a result. Therefore, they do good to others. And people really love seeing these clips. They get millions of views. And we ourselves, maybe if we do that too. There are also researchers that show that people that help others, it makes them feel good even more than taking for themselves. Maybe, I don't know, but I don't really see it in life. What people like watching, that these things get a million views, and that people like telling about it, it's also good. But still, I see that the world's deteriorating. You can especially see it among children, where children don't hide how they feel. How much cruelty you have there many times. And all the struggle of powers. You said that a child finishes school and goes off into life, but many children experience this existential war throughout their childhood, that they have to protect themselves, meaning this evil that's hidden in our nature is revealed very early in life. And therefore, this is the distress that we're starting out from. So what should we aim them at? What is the image of that true good person that we should direct them at? The image of a true good person who knows how to do good to everyone without relating it to himself, for him to benefit as a result, because if he benefits as a result, he'll do it in a limited, restricted fashion, in a certain way, only on condition that he feels some kind of benefit in return, and once he won't feel any kind of benefit in return, that doing good to others doesn't pay off, then he'll stop doing it, and he'll even cause others bad. Because all in all, his ego, his nature, is to receive good from others. So whether it's to treat others in a good or in a bad way, it doesn't matter to a person. The main thing is to receive in return what he wants. And this is how our nature is. And there's no point in expecting for that to change. What's actually the problem with people treating others favorably in order to succeed in society? My ego, which is my basis, does not allow me to behave in a good and nice way to others. I have to get some kind of reward in return, something. And I don't see that I'm getting anything in return. If I'll treat others favorably, then they'll treat me favorably. Okay, happens. I come to some new workplace, and so I treat everyone nicely and favorably and so on. Why? Because I want for them to accept me. Once I'm no longer concerned with them accepting me, I've already been accepted, suppose. I start disregarding them, because my nature forces me to act this way, and there's nothing that you can do. Therefore, there is no point in expecting for us to build a good, nice society out of our own nature, where we treat each other favorably. I feel no benefit as a result. Why do I have to spend so many efforts and energy in order to treat others favorably? It's against my own nature. I want to receive all the time. I want to use others all the time. I want to all the time feel that I'm more important, that I'm stronger, that I deserve more. And in order to give something to someone else, I don't feel any inclination toward that, any drive to do that. Okay. Up until now, we talked about man's egoistic nature that pushes him to do different things. First of all, he wants to be surrounded by good and nice people that will treat him favorably. Sometimes he's willing to treat others favorably if he gets something in return. And if he doesn't get anything in return, he'll stop treating them favorably. Necessarily, he'll stop because that's his nature. So man's like a machine that works according to cost effectiveness, even if it happens in a person subconsciously. This man's nature. Now, when we want to educate a person, what should be our goal? We understand that man's nature is egoistic. This is our nature. It's not good. It's not bad. It's nature. Now, we're living in a society. We want to create some kind of an educational process, the outcome of which will be the best possible person that we can get. What should that person be like at the end of the process? First of all, we have to understand that a person will not do anything good to others unless he'll see some kind of benefit. This I understand. Now, the question is, how can I treat others favorably in return for what kind of benefit will I treat others favorably? So here we have to think, what do we give a person? Suppose religion says that what you'll get is heaven. You'll feel good, things are going to be in your favor. After you die, after 120, you'll die, everyone dies. This is how it is in our world. And then you'll go into a state where you'll be judged. There's always a trial. And then, according to how you treat others, you'll be judged. And then you'll have a true outcome. And then, according to how you treat others, you'll be given a good, nice place in the next life, in the second phase stage. And people buy that because, for sure, at some point we have to part with this life. So, because you have no choice, it's possible to somehow think that there is something. It's better to think that there is something, and if there is something, it's better to buy right now already some good, safe place there, pleasant place, in return for what? For not stealing, killing, this, that, but to do good things to others, and so on. And this is what religion's based on. That's it. This is what people think. We see that throughout human evolution, it doesn't work. It stopped working. It worked for a short period because our ego that forces us to think about ourselves is constantly growing. And it's really growing exponentially in this very sharp curve upwards. And I reach a state where I simply can't think about the next world. What's important for me is this world. If I'll steal and I'll have something here and now as a result of stealing. But later, what will happen to you later? Can't think about that. I simply can't. It's not that I'm saying that I'm stupid, that what am I doing? No, I simply can't. Meaning nature itself did this really special trick on us that we see that we can't work for a better future. Our ego is so narrow, so short-sighted, so simple and foolish that it's like with a little child when I'm telling him, look, you better not do it. I can't. I want it. I want it here and now. We see it on children, and we're the same. And it's a wonder, because actually, those people that founded the religious education or moral education altogether, they were thinking in all nations, throughout the generations, they thought that by that they can arrange human society and for things to be good. And a few dozens or even hundreds of years went by, and we see that all these things fly out the window, that we can't hold people this way, and so we build a legal system. So we'll give them some kind of punishment here, and we'll even give them some kind of reward here and now. They'll be, you know, appreciated by society. We'll talk about them. We'll write about them. We'll give them medals that they're good and nice people. And to the contrary, we'll throw them in jail. We'll say how bad that person is and so on. In terms of a reward, it's a problem. No one wants to work that way. But in terms of punishment, people do take that into consideration as much as they can. So they become more cunning, how to steal in such a way that no one will find out, and so on. And so I see that that's how it works. Still, we can't raise a person, educate, teach a person to be good to others. And we see it today that society is very cunning. It does so many dirty things. Really, everyone's in a lie and filth, and all the more they're proud about it. And they create different laws in order to strengthen the lie, in order to strengthen their ability to be bad to others and justify themselves and so on. This is what's happening. Therefore, today, we're really perplexed. And I have nothing to give to others. I have nothing to give my children. I have no method by which I can think that if I'll publicize it, if I'll study it, and if I'll teach it to my children, they'll have a better world. I don't. And this is our generation that's facing true darkness. They see that there's no way to restrain people. Drugs, murder, prostitution, all those things that I can't even talk about that are already so common in society that I can't say that it seems wrong to me because then they can do to me who knows what. Because there are such behaviors in society that not only that it's a norm, but people are proud of it. If we look at a society of children where you can see that they're really drawn to bad behavior, and the stronger you are, the more dominant you are, there we can really see our nature. So can we expect to see something else from them? No, never. Only worse and worse. Why? Why can't we work with that, change it? How? By what? What can we give a little person or a grown-up person? What kind of reward can we give them that'll pay off for them to be good to others? Not to do bad to others. Okay, somehow we can keep ourselves. Why? Because otherwise we might be harmed. I'll be caught, beaten up, thrown in jail, get a fine. I'll be shamed. even though that shame doesn't work that much anymore. But still. But it doesn't force me to do good things. It only forces me not to openly do bad things. What then? Maybe we can talk a bit about what can this generation facing the darkness do differently. We only need the recognition of evil, that this way we cannot advance, that we're reaching a state that's real darkness, that I see everyone on the street as my enemies, haters, people that can't talk to each other, that think poorly about each other, that to begin with are willing to do bad to others, to the closest people. And that as if we can no longer exist this way. When I'll see that I can no longer exist this way, even at home, even in my family, as it says, it's written, a person's enemies are his household. Something like that. That the people that live together with him at home, they're the ones that are his enemies, that hate him. So, if so, I'll already see that I'm pushed into a corner and there's nothing I can do, and I'm told, now we will teach you how to have a good life. Do you want it, or do you want to continue with this? Then maybe I'll agree to at least listen. And then we have to invent a method of education for that person, but a method of education that covers for everything. Not to be a bit better, not to hit each other like we tell children, but a method, an educational method that will really change human nature. You hear that? Human nature. Not that you'll keep yourself against your evil inclination, nor not to harm others. And then you'll live that way as if like good children. It's not good. But somehow, like we handcuff them, we tie them up or something. That's called that they're good kids. Unless we correct their evil inclination, they're not good. They remain bad. So I have to give a person such an education that will change their nature, that instead of a bad person, that person will become good. And then that person will behave according to the good and nice attitude that he has towards others. How's that possible? In this education, there should be, in the meantime, two levels. The one level is that I do good to others because I get a very nice reward in return. And such a reward that doesn't depend upon others, but that it's as if from heaven. That if I treat others favorably, I'm on a roll in life. I have everything abundantly. I understand that as a result, I grow nicely. The matter of this world, the next world, like we said, things like that, on the one hand. On the other hand, the result, the outcome of this education that I'm forced to keep in order to be rewarded, the reward is that I become a good person myself. That I'll have a good nature, that I'll want to treat others nicely and favorably, that I won't want to be bad to others. And then, if I reach that, I have no problem. It's not hard for me to do good things, nice things for everyone, to hug everyone, to live in a good, nice world, and bestow and love and giving, really open to everyone. This is what education has to bring me to. And I know only one method, the educational method of the wisdom of Kabbalah, that can bring us to that. And unless we change our nature from egoistic to altruistic, nothing will help. Our time's almost up. And maybe as a final question, you just said that the method of education of the wisdom of Kabbalah can really create a change in human nature, that at the end of this educational process, a person will feel that what he wants is to benefit others. Why does he want to benefit others? What does it give him? What's the incentive? What does he get? Yeah, what does he get in return that suddenly his desire changes that he wants to benefit? What do you get now when you do bad things to others? You get pleasure. You're proud about it. You're better than that other person. You derive pleasure from the bad actions. So you'll derive pleasure from good actions. It's actually creating a new human being, new, that starts enjoying giving to others, that also starts feeling that the others and himself are one and the same, that we're all as one, not as brothers, but truly as one body. So that person's desire to benefit others is a result of his entire perception of him and the others in reality changing from one end to the other. True. This is the result of Kabbalistic education. Dr. Lightman, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Tal. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.
Michael Lateman, on Quora, what is the importance of interdependence in nature? Interdependence in nature exists on its still, vegetative and animate levels. No created being, including human beings, can exist on their own, separate from other beings. In nature, there is a constant exchange of substances with their environment. Even a rock feels its environment and the environment feels the rock through several forces and systems that we have yet to fully understand. Also, the higher up the levels of nature we go, and also between the levels, the more interdependence there is. There is a very tight connection between the still, vegetative, animate and human levels of nature. We people are, on one hand, part of the animate world, intimately connected to the still, vegetative and animate levels of nature. However, on the other hand, due to the human ego, we want control and power over nature, to make nature submit to our demands. Such an inclination backfires on us, as the subjective ego is blind to what it really needs in order to truly benefit itself. We are all parts of a whole interdependent and interconnected system. However, our egoistic attitude disrupts, corrupts and brings about imbalance in such a system. Today, we live in an era where we are becoming more and more aware of the extent to which we harm nature, ourselves and our future generations. Moreover, we seemingly do not care much, if at all, about the harm we cause, which is also due to the same ego. Therefore, the importance of interdependence in nature is that it should lead us, humans, to acknowledge how we think and act contrary lead to such interdependence, in our egoistic attitudes to each other and to nature. In order to reach balance with nature's interdependence, we need to change our attitudes to each other so that they match the overriding attitude in nature, egoistic to altruistic, divisive to connected. We will then enter into balance with nature and experience a whole new kind of harmonious existence, the likes of which we cannot even imagine right now. Written, edited by students of Kabbalist Dr. Michael Leitman. Passover from the point of view of modern realities, Part 2. Question. Why did Pharaoh, while he wanted the Jews to stay in Egypt, order the boys to be thrown into the Nile but not girls? What is this power of boys? Why were they killed and not the girls? Answer, women are always passive, they can obey. This is their nature. So, nothing will happen to them if they are left without their men. We will use them to our advantage, and that's it, to use crude human language. But, in principle, it is not about this but about the fact that in every person there is a female and a male source. If one kills his male nature, that is, the intention to bestow, connect, and unite with the Creator, then all his actions become feminine, small, for their own sake, at the level of our world, and they do not affect anything but destroy the nation. From Cab TV's News with Dr. Michael Leitman, April 12, 2019. My new article on LinkedIn to solve migrant crisis, redefine humanitarian crisis. Fox News reported that in March alone, border officials encountered 172,000 migrants at the border. A 71% increase from February and the latest indicator of the extent of the crisis at the southern border. The 172,000 migrants included 18,890 unaccompanied children, a 100% increase from the already high numbers encountered in February, and the highest number recorded. Once across the border, these children are crammed into pens where thousands occupy spaces that were built to contain no more than 250 children. These pens are not only grossly overcrowded, they are a breeding ground for violent and sexual assaults on helpless children. Already, the stories coming from these coops are heart-wrenching. By all accounts, this is a horrifying humanitarian crisis, and its solution is nowhere in sight. I think we need to redefine humanitarian crisis to include the human part of the crisis even before we consider the material part. The reason these crises are happening is that people do not receive the proper education before they immigrate. They are promised a land of unlimited opportunities and end up in cages, or refugee camps, or dropped off buses in a small town in the middle of nowhere and left alone. Currently, a humanitarian crisis is defined as a series of events that are threatening in terms of health, safety or well-being of a community or large group of people. To solve such crises, various aid organizations provide material assistance to those affected by the predicament. In this way, we do not prevent future crises, do not help the people affected by them, but merely keep them alive and suffering. Emergency provision of food, tents, and basic medical assistance may look good in pictures circulated in order to draw more funds for the organizations that thrive on the suffering of the victims, but they do nothing to solve the problem. Therefore, I think we need to redefine humanitarian crisis to include the human part of the crisis even before we consider the material part. The reason these crises are happening is that people do not receive the proper education before they immigrate. They are promised a land of unlimited opportunities and end up in cages, or refugee camps, or dropped off buses in a small town in the middle of nowhere and left alone. A border should be closed for everyone except those that a country wants to admit after testing that applicants meet the required criteria. If people want to immigrate to a new country to improve their condition, they should first make the necessary preparations, learn the language of the new country, acquire required work skills so they don't become a burden on a new country's welfare system, and acquaint themselves with the basic civics of their future home. The current situation where people are flooding the border is a recipe for disaster. It is already happening, but it will grow much worse. In simple words, it is a suicidal policy. If it continues, we will begin to see migration in the opposite direction where the educated and affluent relocate to more sustainable societies. The pouring of migrants into the United States rattles the pillars of democracy. It will not be long before they collapse and America falls from the zenith to the nadir. Still, as long as this scenario has not materialized, it is possible to avoid it. It takes resolve, but I don't see what other option this mighty nation has. Passover from the point of view of modern realities, part 1. Comment: let's look at Passover from the point of view of modern realities. When the Jews descended into Egypt, there was a flourishing not only for the people of Israel but also for Egypt. And suddenly, this power, this large number of Jews started to frighten the Egyptians. My response: it is not about the large number but about Jewish control over Egypt. Pharaoh was not stupid. He quickly realized that he had a serious force in his hands and he put Jews above all the overseers, commanders, etc. It was then that they built the pyramids and everything, and Egypt became very rich. So, later on, the Pharaoh did not want to let them leave Egypt. But they quickly realized that they had nothing to do in Egypt, that they could live on their own, and they started to slowly get ready for the journey. And that is when problems arose. This suits modern realities very well. We saw in the example of European and other countries that when Jews came to a country from places they were expelled from, the country that expelled experienced declines in its economy, culture, etc., and the country they came to rose and flourished. Of course, this caused great damage to those countries that refused them. We can also see this in the case of Egypt, which has not recovered since then. Egypt, when it was a great culture, built its pyramids and to this day sells them. From CabTV's News with Dr. Michael Leitman, April 12, 2019. The desire to give. Question: there is an expression, the desire to give. What is its root, its attribute, and its development? Answer: the desire when I want to give is the desire to bestow. There is nothing other than the desire to bestow, the creator, and the desire to receive, the created being. The fact that we see concrete items and objects around us is an illusion, and all this actually does not exist. Initially, there was only one desire, the creator, the desire to bestow, which later created a desire to receive. These two desires exist one opposite the other. In order to give the desire to receive independence, it was created and developed with the intention for itself. To the extent that it feels the desire for its own sake, meaning the ego, it is separate from the creator. As one moves away from the creator, the desire to receive at the same time feels that it is detached from something and wonders, why do I exist? What is happening to me? Who manages me? All these questions remain empty, unanswered, and then it starts looking, who created me, for what, and why? Gradually, it begins to act, to make progress in the search for its source, and eventually it finds the desire to bestow. When one begins to understand that another desire exists around him, a desire for bestowal, but he exists inside himself and does not feel that he is in the desire to bestow, all kinds of conflicts and decisions take place in him. Then we can speak about a created being who wants to exit himself and be in contact with the Creator. Question: is the desire to give the initial, original desire given to a person who enters a group? Answer: when the Creator pushes a person toward him and wants to bring him closer to him, he gives him such desires. He sort of lures a person, he flirts with him. From CabTV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, April 7, 2019. Connecting with our hearts. Question: when we study the preface to the Wisdom of Kabbalah, Tiha, should we be impressed by the material or rather work with it dryly? Answer: you should be impressed by it and try to transform it into sensations. To feel it. We are talking about connecting with each other and connecting with the Creator. And how can we connect? In what? The only way to connect is with our hearts, and heart means sensations. The head, the mind, are necessary only in order to know how best to achieve unity. We use them as tools to achieve connection. From CAB TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, April 4, 2019. Listen, read, and see. Question. In Baal HaSulam's book Shemati, I heard, it is written that a person who is, as it were, in the sensation of hell, understands that the only thing that can get him out is the upper force, from which everything emanates. But for this must he feel this upper force, because only then can he truly ask? Answer, of course. Until a person feels it, everything is pointless. Therefore, Kabbalah does not require any preliminary conditions from us. Just listen, read, and see everything this science is talking about. It reveals the force that changes you in the same way a child changes in our world by acquiring new properties as he is growing up and becoming different every day. An adult does not become different. He fills himself with all sorts of new impressions and delights. But a child is changing, gaining more and more. This is the way Kabbalah, as it acts on us, as adults, raises a new person in us. Therefore, we acquire new properties, a new mind, and feel new every day. This is a special property due to which we become Adam equal, similar, to the Creator. This will certainly happen. You just need to open the book and study systematically. There is every possibility for that on the internet. I invite everyone. And people will see what changes take place in them literally from day to day, or at least from week to week. Kabbalah invites us to become as naive as children in order to get closer to the perception of the new reality that should be revealed for us. And if we behave this way, we will really become adults. From CAB TV's The Power of the Book of Zohar, number 9. Opposite elements of creation. Question. According to Kabbalah, what is the main difference in the nature of male and female parts? Answer, absolutely everything. There is nothing more opposite in nature than a man and a woman. Moreover, this difference increases all the time. It first begins to manifest in inanimate objects, even in minerals, then in plants, even more in animals, and even more in humans. That is, a developed man and woman, if they are really highly developed as personalities, represent the most opposite elements of creation. There can be nothing alike in them. Therefore, it is very difficult for them to come to some kind of agreement. They simply do not understand each other and cannot in any way get closer to be in likeness to each other. Question, that is, all their attempts to understand each other's view of the world, in principle, fail? Answer, in the end, yes. We see that we are gradually entering a big crisis. Children leave home, parents get divorced, they cannot bear each other, a person hates himself. He not only cannot get along with the opposite sex, but he also has all sorts of abnormal drives and realization of sexual needs. In general, gender, marriage, family, and children. All this in our time is beginning to literally crumble and get out of control of previous laws and conditions. Therefore, there is a Kabbalistic methodology that explains how we can really come to unity. It is a whole system of knowledge. From CAB TV's Close Up, August 11, 2009.